This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast about problematic faves, great trash, difficult art, so on and so forth, produced by Manawatu People's Radio. Te reo irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu with the support of New Zealand On Air, so cheers for that, guys. This evening, I am talking to Josh Borman of Worst of All Possible Worlds and Ill-Conceived. Ill-Conceived. Hello. Incidentally, a show that you should absolutely be listening to if you're wondering why the world is gestures vaguely like that. We can get into that more later, perhaps. But welcome, Josh. How's it going?
Thank you for having me. I am extremely excited. One of the things that I love going... One of the things that I love about going on other shows, doing such a good job as a guest so far, obviously, with being really good at talking... is that it gives me the opportunity to really lock in a bit more about stuff that I don't necessarily get to talk about on my shows with the same level of depth. And, you know, on The Worst of All Possible Worlds and Ill-Conceived, actually, we cover quite a bit of stuff that is connected to the culture of evangelical Christianity. So it's not as if I've never explored this world before, but nor have I gotten the opportunity to focus in on Australia's finest... Christian contemporary music band Newsboys. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, and I had a stunning revelation because you said basically listen to the greatest hits album. So that's what I did, and then yes. I went and listened to some newer stuff because you also suggested that for reasons that we'll get into. Mm-hmm. But the thing I realized in the course of listening to the greatest hits is that they actually broke containment in New Zealand precisely once. The song Take Me to Your Leader was a crossover hit. Yes, I actually knew Take Me to Your Leader, and I did a completely unscientific poll. I posted on Blue Sky, and I also messengered some friends who are approximately my age. And yeah, people didn't remember the song, but when they listened to it, they were like, oh shit, that chorus. Yeah, no, I know that.
Take me to your leader. Did it cross over in Australia too?
Now that yes, I was about to say now that I don't know, but yes, I had one random person who is Australian reply to the post. I don't know why they follow me.
Probably because you do this great podcast, I would have to imagine.
I have like very minor tabletop role playing infamy as well.
Okay.
But they...
it's probably that. The song's called Take Me to Your Leader. That's something you might say in a tabletop.
Yeah. Nerd stuff. But people did remember that one. And I think like they remembered, they didn't necessarily click that Newsboys were a Christian band. They sort of received them as maybe like a budget own brand Smash Mouth. Or something like that.
Yeah, particularly the stuff around that era is definitely great value Smash Mouth. Absolutely.
So I mean, like that was an astounding moment. I'm also really interested to get a window into like the evangelical music thing because it's something that I kind of just kind of became more and more aware of existing on the edge of my reality as I got older. When I was a teenager, my friends and I would go and hang out in the Octagon, which was like my town's version of a square. There was nothing to do. It was 1997.
You didn't get into fights there, I'm assuming? It wasn't that kind of Octagon?
No, it had a like a shit fountain that's not actually a fountain. It's just like a permanent waterfall at about sort of waist height. That was the most exciting thing it had in it.
Perfect.
But when we were hanging around doing nothing, some group of local evangelical Christians would rock up in a van and they would offer like hot drinks and cheese rolls, and they would play Christian music really loud through like shitty horn speakers on top of the van.
Well, and there's always a catch with those people, right? Where at first it'll be like, here, have a nice little cup of hot chocolate, have a nice little sandwich. But you don't just get to take the thing and leave. No, they're going to let you know about the word of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Well, the particular strategy that they had was that they would ask you questions that they already knew the answers to.
Yes, leading questions, absolutely.
Which, like, so my religious background, insofar as I have one, is that my mum was a Quaker. Her dad was a literal card-carrying communist, when you could be such a thing. But he also believed that children had the right to make their own spiritual decisions. And so she realized that a really good way to piss him off was to insist that she wanted to go to church. And he would have to, despite believing that religion was the opium of the people, grit his teeth and take her. And then she eventually wound up at the Quakers and it stuck. But the Quakers are very like, you know, you have to come to it by yourself and be convinced. And they're very like they absolutely don't believe in separating from the world. You know, you have to be in the world and comment on the world and usually get into fights with your government about where it's sending the army and that kind of stuff. And so when they asked me questions that they knew the answer to, I knew a different answer. And it was always, you know, uncomfortable for both of us.
What kinds of questions and answers are we talking about here?
Oh, well, so, I mean, they were going to the, like, you know, do you think that you're a good person? How would you know that you're a good person? How can we be, you know, how can you make sure that you save your soul? All that kind of stuff.
Right.
And the Quaker line on all of that is much more about the idea that God kind of treats you like a plant that he's growing. Like you have the potential to grow into this wonderful thing that God has given you, but it's kind of your responsibility to grow that way, and God will try and help. But it's not really the same, like you must say these specific words in this order so that Jesus will like hand you the key.
We're all kind of like works in progress at the end of the day, and to declare oneself to be good or bad is I feel kind of missing the point.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, what these guys were playing was mostly I couldn't tell you what the name of the band was, but it sounded like Nirvana's Greatest Hits but with Christian lyrics. So they were
was it the band DC Talk? Is there a possibility that one of the songs that they sang was called Jesus Freak, where they asked, what will people think if they say that I'm a Jesus freak? And it sounds exactly like Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana.
You know, the melody that was being ripped off was definitely Smells Like Teen Spirit.
I think I know the band and the song.
Well, so that connects to the Newsboys story because DC Talk comes
sure
into
does.
This later. Anyway, like that exposed me to these people who I hadn't kind of realized existed. And then like later on, people would just kind of out themselves as being part of this world in ways that were really weird. We had like a Buddhist nun come to our school. I think she was a Tibetan nun because it was during the Free Tibet thing, and like lead people in a very basic like guided meditation for world peace kind of thing. But this one guy insisted on being let out of the school auditorium because he claimed he could feel like talons tearing into his skull.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spiritual warfare.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And like
right into my veins with that, please.
Again,
I love it.
Like, absolute space alien shit, right? Like, I had no context for what was going on.
Right. And I think this is sort of where I should reveal that the reason that I know about all this stuff as much as I do is that it is the world that I grew up in, right? And so to the question of, like, are you good? Are you bad? Are you pure? Are you sinful? My answer to that, at least in terms of the ideology I grew up with, is yes, I am a sinner, as are we all. Total depravity is a core component of human nature. We are only purified and redeemed by the sacrifice of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and therefore we owe everything to God, our livelihoods, our morality, and our entire sense of being, that we as acting agents, to the extent that it's even allowable under the Calvinist ideal, which is to say not very much, honestly. God plans pretty much everything in advance, you know. But to the extent that you can consider yourself an acting agent, it's only thanks to the mercy of God to send Jesus down and, you know, save us.
And the thing that I find fascinating about, just to turn to the Newsboys, is that, like, the thing that struck me across their greatest hits is they have the attitude of, like, you know, a ska band of snotty teenagers talking about how, like, the cops beat them up and that's not cool.
Right.
But it's just about how you shouldn't be ashamed to be a Christian, which was not a problem that I saw any of the people who were, like, demonstrating those kind of, that kind of Christianity ever seemed to have.
Oh, of course. But you have to understand, of course, that the United States of America in the 90s was a terrifying time to be a Christian. There was horrible shit happening everywhere. We'll all, of course, remember the roving gangs of anti-Christian government agents who would go door to door and ask people if they were a Christian. And then if they said yes, they'd get shot in the face. It was crazy.
I mean, I suppose that is like, that is a thing to bear in mind from my point of view, which is that despite being Australian, they are quite an American phenomenon.
They're so American, it hurts. Because they pretty promptly relocated to the U.S. I think, like, their first album, they were... Because they're from, Mooloolaba? Is that how you pronounce it?
Think so, yeah. My Australian...
Which is Queensland.
Yeah, I noticed... Because you'd mentioned that they were Australian. I was like, oh, yeah, cool, Australian bands. Because the pipeline in New Zealand is if you get big enough to be a serious band in New Zealand, you go to Australia.
Right.
Because we simply do not have enough people to make, like, being in a band a feasible day job. And then if you get big in Australia, you go to, like, you know, the world.
Yeah, you go to LA or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But so I was expecting some kind of like some Australian accents or something, but then I got the song Breakfast, which you can't get Captain Crunch in New Zealand. And I had to go and check, and you can't get Captain Crunch in Australia either. You can import it.
Really?
Yeah, but it's an American brand.
I will say they have Captain Crunch in Australia. They have Captain Crunch in Canada. But it's a different recipe. When I was up in Canada a couple times ago, it even looks different. So I like looked at it. I tasted like this is fucked up. Can I say fuck on this show?
Oh,
if
absolutely.
Not, I made a mistake. this is a disaster. This doesn't look like Captain Crunch at all. This is a horrible other thing. And half the box is written in French. What are we doing here?
Our local bigots get up in arms because we have lots of bilingual signage in Māori, which, of course, causes all right-thinking white people to immediately crash their car because they can't understand what street they're on as soon as it's not, you know, written in English like three times the size. If the writing's the same size, you crash your car and die.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, you just get so distracted by the signage that it kills. It's the highway sign that kills you instantly.
Yeah.
Yes. So, can I ask, like, what was your connection as a kid in this world to this band? Like, were they your thing?
This is a story that I have been wanting to tell for a very long time. So. When I was a kid, I listened to our local Christian radio station. It was called Way FM because like, you know, way, like the way, the truth and the light is our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Call sign WAYG in Grand Rapids, Michigan, 89.9 FM. And one of the regular programs on that station was a call-in show called Rick at Night. Because the DJ's name was Rick, and he was doing it at night. And it was a play on the Nickelodeon programming block Nick at Night, which is just, you get it? It's so funny. This is the stuff that we thought was funny in Grand Rapids, Michigan, circa 1998. Anyway, what you could do is you could call in, because they had the classic, like, and if you're the first caller to call in and answer this question, we'll send you blah, 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 blah in the mail. And so I called in. I got on the radio. I answered the question correctly. I don't remember what the question was, but, you know, I was in. And within a week or two, I had a video cassette sent to my house of the Newsboys Step Up to the Microphone tour. It was the VHS of that concert tour, and I watched that tape many times. Up until that point, I was not a fan of Newsboys. In fact, I had listened to a few of their songs because they came up before on the radio, and I was like, this is fine. But the thing is, when you're, you know, 8 years old or 9 years old or whatever, and you just have this one thing to watch, and because you grew up without going to concerts and stuff like that, you see this like, oh my God, like this is a rock concert. This is live. They're doing it for real. This is my favorite band ever. And so it wasn't too far after that that like I then bought some of the CDs and listened to that for a while. And then in, I believe it was 2000, it was either 2000 or 2001, I can't remember, they did a tour. And it was the Love Liberty Disco Tour to promote the album of the same name. And they came to, I can't remember which church it was, but basically the concept was that it was a touring, they brought their own stage. It was like a dome that they would put up in the parking lot of a church or whatever, and the whole show was inside the dome. And that was the first like concert I ever saw.
That is like, there's an incredible amount of like high production stuff that goes into this kind of church and Christianity that, again, And this is partly it's the Quakers who are, you know, not big into ostentation, but it's also like New Zealand. Everything happens in like really tired looking conference centers and is always at least slightly shit. So the idea of like, you know, an extravaganza is very, very foreign to us.
Well, and this is the other thing, too, about Christian music sort of around the turn of the millennium, is that there was more money in that industry at that time than, I mean, that was the peak. That was the peak of CCM, was like late 90s, early 2000s in terms of the money flowing in. I mean, I do think also now, actually, CCM seems to be on a bit of an uptick again because it just sort of turns out that the ascendancy of this kind of Christian music tends to correlate with the rise of fascism. Huh, wonder why that is. And at the time, they could make enough money from the label, because also at that point, everything was still label first, right? And people were buying albums and people were buying stuff like that. It made enough money that you could capitalize a tour where you have your entire own stage that you set up in a parking lot. And The other thing that they were sort of known for, to the point of showmanship, is Peter Furler, who was the lead singer of Newsboys for quite a while, after the original lead singer, John James, left the band because he developed a really, really bad cocaine addiction and just at some point had to be like, I'm out. I can't do this anymore. This life is sending me down a bad road. And before the other lead singer, who I think we're going to talk about in a little bit, Furler actually started as the drummer. It was sort of like a Phil Collins Genesis situation where he ascended from being the drummer to being the lead singer. So sort of the core showpiece of the Newsboys live show was Furler and Duncan Phillips, who has been their drummer for the past like 20 years, getting on this double drum kit platform and doing like a drum duet. And the platform goes up and it rotates and then it goes on its side. And so they're like rotating and they're strapped into these seats. It's really cool, actually.
That's really cool.
And they also, of course, do all the other shit. Like when they sing Breakfast, they have a box of Cap'n Crunch and they're, you know, throwing Cap'n Crunch out into the other shit like that. You know, they are showmen. And as a 9 or 10 year old or however old I was, or 12 year old, I genuinely don't remember. I was like, this is crazy. I can't believe that you can do this. I cannot believe that this is possible to do in a live context. This is just rocking my mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, particularly, I'm guessing the earlier stuff from that Greatest Hits, it's really earwormy, and and it is like, it sounds like a bunch of guys having a lot of fun in a way that feels unusual for my perception of contemporary Christian music, at least.
Yeah, it's a lot cheekier, is the best way that I can put it. It has a sense of impish humor to it that is pretty much entirely lacking elsewhere in the genre, I would say. Because it's also... I realize there's delay here, and that's part of what's messing us up. We're going over an entire ocean and then some. But I think it's also that all of them, so many of the other bands take themselves so seriously, right? And Newsboys at least cultivated an image that they didn't take things seriously. And this, of course, contrasted with the fact that they were working incredibly hard and touring aggressively. And, you know, you don't get to that point without doing a lot. But they always put forth this image of, oh, yeah, we're just kind of messing around.
Yeah, yeah. And like, you're right about the musicianship, right? There's the kind of perennial viral clip. I don't know who the band is, but it's some Christian band, I think, from like the 70s, and they do a song called "Jesus Is a Friend of Mine," but it's like
it's a ska thing. Great. That's an absolute classic of the genre.
That's right. But like the thing that sells it is they lock in, right? They are incredibly tight.
The guy looks like Donny Osmond.
Mm-hmm. I love that video so much.
So, like, did you then like follow them through their various permutations? Because I guess the other thing about Newsboys that I think probably leads to some of the stuff that we're going to have to talk about is they do kind of become a brand unrelated to the composition of the band.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I think is another thing that I think is interesting about this band, is that they are somewhat chameleonic, right? The band that they were in the 80s is different from the band they were in the 90s, which is different from the band that they were in the 2000s. Because once it got to sort of I'm trying to remember what the year was. I'm actually just looking through Wikipedia right now to make sure that I get this right. Like, when it was that Peter Furler actually left the band, the lead singer.
Is it after Step Up to the Mic?
It was well after Step Up to the Microphone, because Step Up to the Microphone was way back in, that's like 97, I would say. And so, okay, here we go. Right. Furler was lead singer up until like 2009. And at that point, there was a different lead singer who took over. But I should say, even before that, from roughly 2003 forward to 2009, they entirely shifted their focus away from making this very cheeky Christian pop rock to just making worship songs. And this is the thing, and this is, I think, a big piece of the reason of why they did this. A big market shift started to happen in the 2000s, where it was a better and more reliable way to make money by writing these worship songs, because then they could be licensed to churches. Because churches, to sing these songs in church, which are copyrighted, every single church has to pay for an ASCAP BMI license. And these songs, particularly the very, very popular ones, get a lot of play, such as it is in churches. And I think they very shrewdly realized, because these guys are very shrewd people, that was the play. That we were going to be moving away from a while from this radio-friendly kind of stuff, where it was like, oh, we'll just make like regular radio, but for Christians, and realized that it made more sense to focus in on the Christian church market. Because, you know, what happened in, you know, the year 2000, George W. Bush got elected. And at that time, the country was thankfully saved from the evil Bill Clinton and his lecherous ways. But it also meant that, like, Christians, particularly in the run-up to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, were becoming a lot more aggressively, like, in the church and using their position in the church for political leverage. Because that's the other thing. These two projects are intrinsically connected. The cultural piece of it and the political piece of it.
So just like in terms of, because I'm not in it and I've never really been in it, like how would you characterize what the worship music thing is at this point in time?
So I would say that the worship music, well, for one thing, I went on actually another podcast to talk specifically about worship music, a show called Hate Speech. I love them. I would recommend going and checking that episode out, any episode. But basically the gist of it is that these are very simple melodies that are placed in a register that most people can sing.
Right. Yes, of course, because that's what classic hymns are as well, right? If you go back to like
exactly
Wesley writing hymns for the Methodists, he's writing basic melodies in registers that are friendly so that everyone can pick them up.
Even with the classic hymns, there still are sort of sometimes pretty complex harmonies within it. That's not the case with this kind of music, though. Everybody's singing the melody. Generally speaking, this is going to, all of the notes within the melody are going to fit within an octave and a half type range. And there are other types of worship music that are more, I guess you could say, performative. And Hillsong, which is another Australian church, really more of a brand at this point than anything else, they actually delineate between their worship songs that anybody can sing, which is just Hillsong music. And then they've also got showier, bigger stuff that only like really vocally talented people can sing. And that's called Hillsong United. And it sounds similar musically, but the big difference is that, you know, the Hillsong United stuff is actually pretty technically demanding.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, because I'd seen, so my day job here at NPR is that I teach people how to use our gear so that they can make their own radio shows and podcasts. And some of the people who do that come from a variety of churches who make use of music like Hillsong. And so I see the different labels going past, and I had always wondered what that meant. Now I know.
Mm-hmm. Now I know. And this is, again, not uncommon in this world where the desire, I think, well, maybe it's not the desire, but it's certainly the end result, is that you end up with these markets that are targeted towards slightly different audiences and also targeted toward different abilities and range of abilities. And all of these, again, I can only call them brands because that's what they are. They all augment each other in different ways. So if you're the kind of person who wants to experience the full range and can sing the full range, you can get the full range of worship music and do all of that. Or you can get your church's most talented person to do the solo of a Hillsong United song, right? Or you just go with the mainline shit that everybody can do. And the latter piece is what the Newsboys made a lot of songs in. Because, sure, you know, you can listen to Peter Furler sing that, or you can do it yourself. And at the end of the day, if you're doing it yourself, then Newsboys get that sweet, sweet licensing money.
I mean, it's incredibly workmanlike, right? It's that absolute, like, the music industry is an industry, being in a band is a job. We turn the crank handle and songs come out at a regular interval, which, like, I have to say, just as a musician, I really admire the capacity to do that, but also, like, wielding it for evil.
It's also the two sides of the coin of something that is, and I think that's an excellent word, workmanlike, which is that, you know, at its best, such as it is, something that is workmanlike is functional and works very effectively for that function. But on the flip side of it, I think that once they enter their worship era, the little bit of edge that they had, the thing that kind of made them interesting and distinctive, the thing that allowed Take Me to Your Leader to be a crossover hit, that's gone now. That's just gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating conversation. I think we will pick up there in just a second, but we need to take a really quick break for station messages. We will be back right after this.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information.
And we're back. You're listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast produced by Manawatu People's Radio with the support of New Zealand On Air. I'm talking to Josh Borman about the Australian, although more American than Australian, really, Christian band Newsboys. And we were just talking before the break about the way in which, like, they become over the course of their career, whether they start this way. I mean, probably because they immediately leave Australia for Nashville. They increasingly become like a machine band, you know, an industry band that just spits stuff out. And I think that's what leads to the other thing that you need to talk to when you talk about Newsboys, which is the connection with DC Talk, the entry of Michael yes. Tate. Do you want to explain how this works?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So along with Newsboys, there is really one other really big band that came out of the CCM scene in the 90s, and that is a band called DC Talk.
And they now, are big DC, enough that as a non-Christian music listening person, I immediately recognized the name DC Talk.
Right. And DC Talk was founded by three guys, Kevin Max, Toby Mack, and Michael Tate. They all went to college together at Liberty University. So DC Talk refers to the District of Columbia. It's the fact that Lynchburg, Virginia is a hop, skip, and a jump away from DC. And the talk, of course, is that they are, well, talking about our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, naturally. And what happened was they came up for a while. They had a few albums, all of which were massive, massive hits within the world of Christian music, particularly their album Jesus Freak. But these guys did not get along at all. They were regularly fighting with each other. And there's a particularly funny video that is out there where they are touring in support of a greatest hits collection that they had recently put out. And throughout the entire thing, it is like, a half hour or hour special that was on a Christian TV station. And you can just tell that, like, at any moment it could pop off. And not long after that interview, actually, it did. And they disbanded. And Michael Tate, who was one third of the band, and it should be said, he's sort of like, his voice is, he's got a little bit of like a rock edge to it. And if you listen to their music, there's the three guys. Kevin Max has kind of like a, I don't know, punkish, like crooner kind of thing going on. Toby Mack likes to rap. And Michael Tate is more of a rock vocalist. And that was what his next project was a band called Tate, of which he was the lead singer. And in 2009, after Peter Furler announced that he would be leaving the Newsboys, at around that same time, they announced that Michael Tate would be joining as their new lead singer. I should also note, DC Talk, two white guys and a black guy, the black guy in that band, Michael Tate. So this is relevant because some of the things that we are going to talk about in a moment, there are some interesting dynamics here that are to do with the way that race operates in the United States. And it's important to have that context piece just framed up right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Like, if you want stuff completely unrelated to the Christian music world, you can look at like the genuinely repulsive way that Chris Brown behaved, but then you can compare the reception of that to similar repulsive behavior by white musicians and
right.
The yeah, exactly. I mean, it's absolutely a thing. So the big thing that happens sonically there is that there is an absolute change. They come out of worship music and they start making, instead of kind of own brand Smash Mouth, they're much more like own brand One Republic or like
yes.
own brand early Maroon 5 or something like that.
I would say One Republic is definitely a closer representation of the kind of thing that they're doing. And how much of the Michael Tate era stuff did you listen to?
I listened to maybe about half of three songs or something, and it got a bit samey for me.
It all sounds the same.
Yeah, I vibe less with One Republic than I do with Smash Mouth from a standing start. Like, you know, Smash Mouth at least have some energy and some groove, despite being some of the goofiest men to walk the earth. And
I should say, though, right now, just for the record, the One Republic comparison is particularly interesting because Ryan Tedder, a.k.a. the One Republic guy, came up evangelical, right? And has produced a lot of stuff in the Nashville CCM scene. So even though he has not directly worked with Newsboys, there is a reason that it all kind of sounds like that.
Yes. Yeah, no, that makes sense, actually, because in that case, what I'm hearing is not necessarily them aping One Republic, but One Republic is a kind of CCM sound breaking into the mainstream. Yeah.
That, I would say, is more accurate, yes.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. But the other thing that was going on was that Michael Tate was doing lots of terrible things to lots of young men.
From, like, the very beginning of his time with Newsboys, according to the record, and before, I think.
I mean, it would seem weird if he only started when he joined a new band, as opposed to, like, just being a thing that he was doing as he got more and more kind of power and influence. You know, that's not usually the way that these kinds of people operate.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if I can find a source here with the first sort of allegation and when it was occurred to have happened. But basically, long story short, without going into the details, and you can feel free to go read them for yourself, for a long period of time, he was basically like, first of all, he's gay. He was not openly gay, and still technically, I don't think, admits that he is gay. I think that he has confessed to all of these unwanted encounters, which many of which would seem to fit the legal definition of sexual assault, although charges have not yet been filed or pressed. Basically, the gist of it is that he would regularly come across young men in the places that he was, and, you know, usually like on tour, and he would talk with them, strike up a friendship with them, hang out with them, usually give them some substances of some sort, and then the sort of thing that is consistent across all of these accounts is that as a result, in part of those substances, he would usually touch them or otherwise do things that were unwanted. And this was a very consistent pattern of behavior for a very, very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, obviously it's not the same thing, but it is striking that one of the previous singers flamed out in the midst of a spiraling substance abuse problem, because it's one of those things where I think I sent you a bunch of stuff in the preamble to this conversation, because there was this phenomenon in New Zealand where evangelical churches would give small bands their start because they would pay for gear,
right?
And the perception was that they were like a safer bet for industry people, because they wouldn't get into drugs and alcohol, and they wouldn't get into sex and all of this stuff. But clearly, this is incorrect. And in some ways, it seems like claiming that it doesn't happen made it easier for it to happen.
Definitely. And there are other pieces of this as well, that the band's longtime manager was also implicated in quite a bit of this stuff. And it's really gnarly stuff. And it raises some pretty serious questions around, is there any such thing as accountability when you get to this level of success and fame within the industry? But the reaction to it was also interesting to me, because and by interesting, I mean uniquely infuriating, right? Because once these allegations came out, Tate very quickly put out a statement, and then more allegations started coming out, and, you know, it was clear that the band had gotten ahead of it, because he stepped down before the big articles were published with that were, you know, researched and resourced with people on the record. And then the band got a new lead singer who's a white man. And they then went back on stage at some, I should also say, a whole bunch of their bookings were immediately canceled by the promoters because, as you'd expect. So then they basically just booked a whole bunch of replacement bookings with churches instead. And there's this video of them going up on stage at one of these churches and being like, wow, we didn't know anything. And like, this really snuck up on us and we feel so bad. But you know what feels even worse? What feels even worse is that we're being canceled. And there are a lot of people who are not willing to work with us anymore. And we didn't know anything, you guys. And then everybody's like, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, give me a fucking break.
It's the flip side of the machine band thing, right? What it speaks to is that Michael Tate got wind that this storm was going to happen. He did the responsible thing. He talked to his it's like, you know, you do not by any means have to hand it to ISIS, but he did the responsible thing. He talked to his band and his management, and his band and his management went, all right, well, here's what we're going to do. And they stuck to the plan, and they have played it like exactly down the middle and judged their audience perfectly.
Yeah, which is to say, judge them to be a bunch of rubes. And I just, it is so, it is just fully, it defies any sort of credulity whatsoever, right? To be like, oh, well, they just probably didn't know. No, come on. You're sharing a tour bus with this guy for a decade plus, not to mention that there were other reports of like, apparently shit was just out of control on that bus regularly. Like they were partying, you know, particularly alcohol was sort of the big thing. But that was one of the things that a number of people, and this was consistent across numerous different accounts. It's not as if he was out doing this on the down low without the sort of recognition of his bandmates. They were also partying with him and then turning a blind eye when shit got a little bit too real. Now, does that rise to the level of legal culpability? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe not. But like nothing, at least in these reports so far, would indicate as much. However, there's certainly moral culpability there, ethical culpability to, again, allowing for the absolute best case scenario. They probably had some suspicions about what was going on and actively chose to look the other way because they knew that knowing and finding out would be bad for business. Worst case scenario is they just straight up knew. And that's also very, very possible.
I mean, I would float a hypothetical, which was that they decided that Michael Tate being openly gay would be very bad for business. And they decided that anything involving Michael Tate and anything below the waist simply didn't happen.
Yeah, we just don't talk about it. I think you're right.
Because, you know, you can always say, oh, I had a terrible time with the drugs because of the demons. But ones are trickier sell.
And this is the other piece that just really gets at me is the reaction of the fans, the people listening to this stuff, and particularly regarding his homosexuality, right? Where for a lot of them, it wasn't, here is a man who has taken advantage of his position and also used substances to ply people into, you know, sexual acts without their consent. It's that he was doing all of this and he was gay. And for a lot of them, the gay thing is the part that makes it unforgivable.
Yeah. No, there is that kind of assumption that any man who can will get away with this stuff because of the fundamental nature of masculinity or brackets question mark. But, you know, it's a real pisser. There's no other way to describe it. But I get, like, You know, you don't like to jump up and down about hypocrisy because it's not useful often, but it is so much part of the brand that, you know, this is a show that you could send your kid at age 9 or whatever you were.
Yeah.
And
that's an important piece of it, I think, is that particularly as regarded Christian music at the time and still now, it is a cleaner, safer alternative. It is going to be a safer world for your child, for your adolescent, than what they're going to get out in the real world.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, you know, the real world of musicians is full of creeps and fuck ups.
Absolutely. You've heard the stories about Warped Tour, I'm sure.
Oh, shit. And it exists at every level. You know, like yeah. I used to go to lots of outdoor raves as a teenager. And so I'm still like connected with people who are part of the outdoor rave scene. And I am constantly seeing them have to deal with the fallout of sex abusers and grifters who use the language of that particular community to like get themselves into positions of power and then either do awful shit or just scam people out of a lot of money.
Right.
And like no one seems to be immune to that. But when you sell yourself particularly as the safe place, it's really scary.
Although I would argue in some ways this is a slightly different thing, but I'm just thinking about like raves and stuff like that, right? And also just music and other things, culture that is connected to, I guess, queer culture, right? Which largely seeks to be the antidote to this weird Christian shit that in a lot of cases, the exact same thing will happen in those cultures as well, except that it's now using the language of acceptance and wokeness and whatever you want to call it to accomplish those exact same goals. Nobody is immune from this, I guess is the point that I'm trying to make here. It's just particularly egregious coming from these people who hold themselves as not a moral authority, but the moral authority.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I mean, to return to the guys who were plying me and my friends with hot chocolate and cheese buns at midnight in the Octagon, like that is the kind of position that they were attempting to assume, right? Was like, you guys are misguided youths for being out this late mm-hmm. at night. We are protecting you and saving you by giving you
right.
the truth about everything.
Just love enter the Octagon. No, not to fight, to get hot chocolate from those Christians. Go and enter the Octagon.
You could now enter the Octagon to go to a reasonably good whiskey bar, I think. I haven't been back to that town in some time.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice. The last time I was there, it was cool. Look, thank you so much for coming and talking and shedding some light on this particular like subculture and musical genre that I really did not have any detailed knowledge of. I've got like a couple of questions because we're coming up on time, but like,
sure.
do you think that there are implications for knowing about this stuff for like kind of the way that the world is? Because it seems to me like the people who built this particular like separated ecosystem are kind of more in charge of things than they have been for a long time.
Yeah, I think that the system that was designed to elevate bands like Newsboys is a system that was designed to escape the critical and honestly all of the other forms of accountability that exist in the broader world of music. And this is something that is very common across evangelical Christianity. They consider the structures that have been set up more broadly to be not just bad, but also, I think, illegitimate in many cases. This is not to say everybody. I'm not trying to like paint everybody with a broad brush. There's a lot of nuance in here, to be very clear. But there is this sense of how the only people that we need to be accountable to are our people. The other people genuinely don't matter because their standards, their rules, their whatever are not the same as ours. Now, this presents a very interesting question in, let's say, the United States right now, where those people are in control of the levers of government. I would argue that what we're seeing right now in Minneapolis and previously to that in Chicago and soon to come in New York, is the natural consequence and the natural sort of accumulation of all of those ideas when it is not just a band that plays some kind of weird music that sounds a little bit like Smash Mouth, but when instead these systems of power are utilized as a governing structure. Because also in these networks, it genuinely doesn't really matter that much how effective or good what you make is or what you do. What matters is your ability to stay marketable in one sense, and also to appeal directly to the people who are willing to buy what it is that you are selling.
Yeah, and I guess I want to say for a local context, like, we are, for better and worse, culturally downstream of America in a lot of ways now.
Yeah.
We have large American-style evangelical churches becoming increasingly more powerful. The one that gets the most press is an outfit called Destiny Church, who are a bit more—they're a bit more gangy than evangelical-y. They borrow a lot from like Māori and Pacific gang culture in terms of like look and feel.
Oh, interesting. Does Hillsong have a footprint over there?
Hillsong has a cultural footprint in that a lot of people use their music, and people and pastors travel back and forth across the Tasman with a pretty high degree of regularity. But there are also like increasing numbers of big evangelical churches, and this is not a conversation I can get into because there are fights that are not mine to have. But suffice to say, people that I know have got tied up in those, and they were really instrumental in the big anti-vax protests that happened when we locked down. And that whole movement was really instrumental in the right-wing swell that has led to our current government.
And all of that is exactly the same way here, too, where, like, one of the big resistance points to the vaccination movements here was Christian musicians going out and doing these concerts that at the time were technically illegal because, like, well, who can say that we are illegal but God or whatever?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the other thing that has always struck me about these guys, and we also, there's a thing we don't have time to get into, but there's this whole thing called the Nelson Compromise, where we're not allowed religion in schools. So what they do is they technically close primary schools for an hour so people can come in, deliver Bible teaching while the school is closed, and then it reopens. Those guys and these churches have a very specific kind of Christianity, which is deeply unscholarly and suspicious of people who know things about stuff. And that leads them to very strange conclusions, like the spiritual warfare stuff, and to be quite like hostile to bits of Christianity like the Sermon on the Mount, which I think might have some value.
Well, I don't know. That sounds woke to me.
Well, exactly. Yeah. No, that's precisely it. Yeah. No. Woke Palestinian Jesus Christ. Yeah. Thanks once again for coming and talking. This has been a lot of fun. The last couple of things I like to do are to give you a chance to suggest things and plug things. So, like, would you suggest that people who are not locked into this ecosystem go and check out some of the Newsboys or other related things?
No, not really. I mean, unless you really want to get a sense of sonically what is going on here, right? I think that it makes for an interesting lens into an interesting sort of subculture, and whatever era of Newsboys you are listening to is going to reflect the way that American evangelical culture is responding to the culture more broadly. That's the utility of this music. Beyond that, though, I mean, I wouldn't. It just kind of depends on what your particular jam is, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose like the call would actually be like, you know, if you were really into nu metal, you should go check out POD so you can hear what the Christians were doing with nu metal. And like, it's that kind of a thing. The final thing is, please re-plug your various shows and appearances. If people are not aware of where they can find you, they should be.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, Hugh, thank you so much for having me on. This has been every bit the blast that I was hoping it would be.
My pleasure.
But yeah, no, go check out my shows. If you are interested in evangelical Christianity and the way that it intersects with politics and culture more broadly, I think that both of my shows will be of interest to you. The first show is called Ill Conceived. It is a podcast about natalism, which is the movement that sees demographic decline and the declining birth rates that are occurring, particularly in white countries and some East Asian countries as well, as being the most pressing policy issue of our time. So we are profiling who these natalists are, what their arguments come down to, and both the explicit and implicit messaging. And we've been doing the show for about half a year now. And so far, we have found some connections that are absolutely wild that I would not have begun to dream of, genuinely.
That was the thing I was going to say about Ill Conceived, is that it's a really valuable show because it explains why there is shared ideological ground between, like, historically kind of atheistic, technocratic tech people, although there's this whole vogue for like pivoting to weird Christianity in those guys now as well.
Right.
But like
cultural Christianity, they say.
Yeah, that's right. But like, why would those guys get into bed with evangelicals? Why would evangelicals get into bed with Catholics when, you know, Catholics are like, you know, the Pope is Satan's tool on earth some of the time? All of that stuff is kind of unpacked gradually over the course of that show, and it's fascinating.
Yeah, our first season is more talking about religious natalism, and our second season, which we're still in the midst of, has been talking more about tech natalism. And I don't know what we're going to be doing after we finish that piece up, but trust me, there is no shortage of material.
Nothing makes people get weird more than the concept of like who is allowed to have babies, generally speaking.
The other show that I do is called The Worst of All Possible Worlds. We are a culture and media podcast. We talk a lot about, I mean, everything really: TV, movies, video games, children's Christian radio drama. I know that Hugh, a while back, you interviewed somebody who talked about Adventures in Odyssey. We have done. Pretty soon, we will have done 50 episodes just about Adventures in Odyssey, but we talk about a lot of other stuff, too. Just to give you a sense of our range, it's gone all the way from, like, Casablanca to Mr. Beast. Like, the whole range. We do it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And from the point of view of assessing the relics of an empire in decline, which, you know, a fascinating way to look at the world, vast trunkless legs of stone and so on.
Pretty much, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much once again, Josh. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky, or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatu People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.